Welcome to Season 5 of the Big Sci-Fi Podcast with Adina, Brian, Chris, and Steve, the biggest sci-fi podcast in the galaxy. The adventure is just beginning here at the Big Sci-Fi Podcast, and we invite you to come aboard the Starship Tangent. We know you'll enjoy the conversation, the laughter, the banter back and forth, and most of all, friends who love hanging out to talk about all things science fiction. Set your phasers to fun. Here we go.
Podcasts, the final frontier. These are the recordings of the Big Sci-Fi Podcast. Its ongoing mission, to explore films, TV shows, and literature, to seek out new and interesting people to interview, to boldly go and talk about what we love to discuss, science fiction. Tonight's episode, Davy Perez. However, before we begin, let's introduce the crew of the Big Sci-Fi Podcast. Our captain, Brian Donahue.
Hey, I was waiting for your voice to change.
Say hi.
Hi.
I'm sorry. It was supposed to change like this. I'm sorry. Our engineer and science officer, Adina Mignona.
Hello, hello.
Ship's counselor, Chris Fox.
Hey, everybody.
And me, I'm Steve Merkin, the guy in the red shirt that seems to be always around in the background. First, let me say thank you to our Starfleet Command, better known as Trek Geeks, for making us a part of their podcast team. They've done so much to promote ours and other podcasts like the Sci-Fi Sisters, and we are so thankful to be part of their group. Now to the interviewee. Back on September the 8th, 2023, I was at the Paramount Studios lot to support the writers and actors that make Star Trek and who were on strike. There I saw friends from our podcasts like John Billingsley, Larry Nemechek, Mike and Denise Okuda, and the wonderful Michelle Hurd, who gave me a hug.
Aww.
I also got to meet Walter Koenig for the very first time as well, someone who was there from the very beginning. In addition, I got to meet scriptwriter Phyllis Strong, who worked on Voyager and my favorite, Enterprise, and who we interviewed earlier this year. And then at the end of the day, I was introduced to whom we are interviewing today, Davy Perez. Davy, please say hello to our listeners.
Hello to your listeners. How are you? It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me.
And that's what happens when you're a literal person. You say things. I know we have a multitude of questions to ask you, since you are the writer for Strange New Worlds, one of the writers, that is. I guess the first question I'd like to ask you is, can you keep a secret, Davy?
Yes, absolutely. I'm really good at it, and it's part of my job to keep them.
Good, because listeners, we are not, and we will not be discussing Season 3 of Strange New Worlds in any way, shape, or form. Think of Season 3 as a Christmas gift. Currently, the writers, the actors, the production team are all busy making, wrapping, and putting a pretty bow on Season 3. So we're not sneaking a peek. Sorry. But we will be talking about Davy's work on Season 1 and Season 2, which he has written 4 scripts for those seasons. So without any further ado, I'd like to pose you the very first question. You grew up in East L.A.
Yes, that is correct.
Did you ever go to El Tepeyac for dinner?
El Tepeyac, I must have. I'm pretty sure I have on more than one occasion, yes.
My daughter, Jenny, when I told her who we were interviewing, where you were from, she goes, well, make sure you ask him if he's been there and if he's ever had a Manuel.
I don't know if I've had the Manuel, but I know I for sure have gone to El Tepeyac.
Yeah. For those who don't know, the Manuel is a 5-pound burrito.
Oh, good night.
Yeah.
One time I went there with my buddy Ross, and we attempted to have an eating contest, and I got about 3 inches from the end of it, and I finally gave up. And he pointed and laughed at me. It's a great place. It's a wonderful place to go to, the great food. And so that was the first question, which was posed by my daughter, Jenny. So,
The answer is, of course, who hasn't? And it's been a while, uh-huh. But no, I've not ventured to try and finish the burrito.
It's, well, just get a Hollenbeck. It's only half a Manuel. It's really good. So I guess the real first question I'd like to ask you, and I think it's also in the minds of others, is what was your first experience with science fiction? Was it a book? Was it a TV show? Was it a movie? Can you recall what kind of sparked your interest in this genre?
I mean, this is going to sound like I'm pandering, but the reality is the first movie I saw in the movie theater was Wrath of Khan. I was too young to see it. I was probably about 5 or 6 years old, and my older sister, who was in her preteens, went with friends, and I had to go, and she had to watch me, and it was a double feature. It was Wrath of Khan and Friday the 13th Part 3 or something. Yeah.
Yikes.
So it went, you know,
I'm sorry,
sci-fi and horror front and center, which probably makes sense to a lot of people who might follow the things I do. but I remember everything. I loved the movie instantly. I knew it was the show that my dad would watch like really late at night on syndication. And those conworms, I just freaked out and was like, but like fascinated and obsessed, you know.
That's interesting.
That explains a lot.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some of the episodes of Strange New Worlds are like the darker episodes, the more horror inspired ones.
Supernatural, too. Supernatural came out of that camp. And I do tend to, you know, being born on Halloween and having these films, you know, I think the next movie I saw after that was like Exorcist.
At six years old.
Probably 6 or 7. Yeah. So there's these like this horror and this sci-fi and this way too advanced type of a tone is being imprinted on my young mind. But I was both scared and fascinated by it, you know, and interested in it. And I kind of wanted to understand it so it wouldn't scare me as much. And then now as a writer and a creator, I definitely go to those wells.
Interesting.
Well, definitely with your episodes from season one.
And I have to say, I am in the camp where I love the Gorn reimagined. At first I was like, oh, but then as I thought about it, I'm like, how could they possibly make him look as cheesy as they did in the original series? And for us as an audience to accept it, I mean, it had to be reimagined.
Right.
And it was terrifying, especially the little baby ones.
That's horrifying.
Oh. Well, yeah, I mean, you touch on a lot with that comment, you know, for our show. You know, a lot of the things we try and do is like, what would they have done if they had the money to do it back then, right? And we're not trying to take away or reinvent, or, you know, we are just trying to sort of, as fans of the original series and all the other series that came after, interpret like what was the intent and how can we use that in a new way. And, you know, with the Gorn, and, you know, they were a one episode character, but they mean so much to so many people, and the message of the episode was so important, and they're iconic, you know. So it was, you know, how do we do that? And some people were I felt uncomfortable with it, you know, a little bit, but I also was like, I want to see what we could do in our version of it. And I have to say, like, Akiva, when I met him for the first time on Zoom, as I was, you know, going through the process of trying to get on the show, he said, you know, what are some of your favorite episodes? And I said, oh, you know, Balance of Terror and Arena. And he said, well, you know, I want to do the Gorn. I want to make them the villain of season one. And I said, yes, can I be on the show, please? Now I really want to do that. And so it was something he had in mind. And you know, our interpretation of them was very much guided by sort of his vision of it. And then the more we got other writers on board and I came on board, we all got to collaborate on certain things. And you know, I was just very fortunate to be able to write those two episodes and sort of get into the specifics of some of the mythology as to how they grow, what stage are they, and you know, when they're born, they're so. And I think a conversation we had was, we know that they can build starships. We know that they're intelligent beings.
Right.
But if we want to tell a monster feature story, how do we do that and not like totally undo what we know these creatures are? So it was like, what if they're just when they're babies as part of their development cycle, they're just, that's when they're the monster. And then as they get bigger, they get smarter. And then eventually, you know, there's a whole, there's a probably notes and notes of stuff that never ended up on screen as far as like what their breeding cycle is and why, you know, they're, why so many are born, but then only one survives. And then that's the one that gets to be allowed to kind of develop into adulthood and develop, you know, intelligence and maybe go off and captain a ship and get stuck on a planet with James Kirk someday.
Very interesting about the creation of the Gorn, for because in the first in the first episode you did, you didn't really see them. You just got to see, you just kind of knew about them. They were right. You know, it was more of a submarine adventure in the first one, you know, the battle and trying to find out what's going on, where they are and all that.
But absolutely.
But in the second episode where you revealed them, it took me, when I saw it, I'm going, wait a minute, where have I seen these creatures before? And not in this TOS episode, but it was in Enterprise, the second mirror episode. And in that one, the Gorn was more like how you portrayed them, more vicious, more, you know, bloodthirsty and violent. And I thought, okay, did you guys tap into that? Say, okay, that's the Gorn we want to have in this, in our series.
Well, you know, it's funny because we're fans of everything Trek, and we want all things to make sense. You know, and ultimately we want all things to be true for whichever part of it you like, you know, and so we don't want to take away, but we want to add. And so, you know, we did talk about that there, the, like, as we were talking about the Gorn, there's like other versions of them have been represented. We even talked about the Gorn wedding in Lower Decks, you know, like we wanted to, you know, people are fascinated by these characters and we want them to enjoy them in any way that they enjoy for themselves. And this is just a version of that. And yes, you know, how can we make it make sense that they're intelligent and you can do a moral story in Arena, but also make it make sense that they're vicious and that you know, we didn't want to make them look like a digital Yoshi character that Enterprise, because of the technology at the time, kind of looks. But we wanted to sort of take all these little pieces and put them together and say, yeah, you know, and look, like people, many things can be true. You can say someone is nice and someone is mean, and they can be both things. And you could, so a Gorn can be what it is for this story because we're encountering a specific Gorn and a specific type of phase in its development. And, you know, you could develop or see a Gorn and have a different experience with it. That's the beauty of stories. Like, it, not everything is going to be the same every time, and not every species is a monolith, you know.
We've asked this of other people. I think it's important to ask Davey this. What got you started in writing?
Yeah.
And then let's jump back into the Trek stuff we're passionate
about. Sure, yeah. No, right. I mean, in a lot of ways, I've always been writing. I would journal as a kid just because I had a lot of things going on, as much many young people do. And then I was in bands, and I would write song lyrics, and they'd be a little too, they wouldn't be punchy enough. They'd just be a lot of, like, basically poetry instead of song lyrics. Not that song lyrics can't be poetry, but it was just a thing that I was always doing. And then I actually started to take acting classes. And that's kind of, you know, I wanted to be telling stories on screen or be a part of it. I didn't know how to break in. No one showed me the steps to take. And I just saw, oh, if I can be on screen, then maybe that's the way to do it. And so I went to an acting conservatory. And after about 4 years there, there's like a course where you start to write your own scenes and you come in, you know, and I really liked that. I started to like, well, I just want to do that part of it. Off of that was actually teaching young kids, inner city kids at an acting school. And they all wanted to perform. And so I would like make these little one act play adaptations. And that's really when it codified, okay, I love doing this and I could do this like in my spare time. And so how do I get paid to just do this? And you know, it took a long time to make happen for myself. It wasn't overnight, but the drive and having that passion kind of kept me going to go after it.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing
that. Adina, go ahead.
Okay. So in writing, oh gosh, now how do I phrase this question? When you're writing the Gorn in season one, and you're working on the first of those two episodes, so episode 4 and episode 8, how much of episode 8 do you know while you're writing for? Like, how much of it was written kind of simultaneously versus we're writing this episode, then we're writing this one, then we're writing this one?
It's a good question, because what we did know was the concept of 9. Like, we talked a lot, like what we do.
9, yeah, sorry, my bad.
It's all right. We talk about the characters, and we talk about the journey that we want to take the characters on throughout the season. And so for Lon, we knew she had the backstory about being a Gorn survivor. We knew we wanted her to confront that fear. And then we wanted her to really have to confront it head on and sort of deal with these personal demons. So that arc we knew, which meant that we knew we were going to have the Gorn in two episodes in order for her to have that character journey. And then we talked about the genres of episodes. And so we knew that episode 4 was going to be a submarine movie. And we knew that episode 9 was going to be our horror movie episode. Like, we had planted those to be the genres. And so those pieces of the stories were known before we even broke the specifics of the story beats and then scenes and just, you know, all of that. And another thing that was known, since we bring up 9, we knew as a horror episode, we talked very specifically, what do horror episodes do and what do we like about horror episodes? And very often they kill off a character that you don't expect to die. Especially Hitchcock will do it in the first act.
Oh my gosh, you know? Yeah.
And so we you know, not to bring up the sore subject of Hammer, but I know the question's coming at some point.
It is.
We knew before we knew it was an Andorian, before we knew it was Bruce Horak, before we knew how much we would fall in love with this character and wish we didn't have to do this, we knew we're going to kill our engineer in episode 9. And yeah,
I was going to say, because when we had Bruce on our show, the question I asked him was, when did they tell you, did they tell you you're only going to last 9 episodes? He said, He knew from the very beginning he was only going to last 9 episodes.
So let me kind of follow on that. Is, given that he then had a couple cameos in season 2, was that in response to how much the character was liked, or when was that decided?
Well, that was in response to how much we liked Bruce as an actor, as a person, how much of the just Trek family he became, you know. You can like a character all you want, but that doesn't translate into you now being a Klingon. It's the performer, right? Sure. And so I remember we, in theory, we were like, okay, if we're going to kill the engineer, we really have to fall in love with them for it to mean anything. Yeah. So the character was designed for you to like. But then we did such a great job. We did it too well. It
really well.
Bruce was amazing, and his chemistry with Celia was so great that it was like, I remember like having a moment like, are we going to do this still? Is this the right choice? And ultimately it was like, well, if we're feeling this, then it was successful. We designed it successfully, you know, and so let's commit to it. But because we love Bruce, it was like, where can we fit him in? How do we bring him back? And Trek has a wonderful history and legacy of, you know, being able to bring characters back in makeups and sometimes not in makeups, you know, just bringing them back because you like them. And so we wanted to find a place, and that's how we found the Klingon captain for him in season 2.
So because Bruce is so awesome, I'm going to shamelessly plug something for a second. He is, as of we speak, he's narrating my book, my latest science fiction novel. He's
Lunar
doing the audiobook for that.
Lunar Logic.
So just have to plug that since we brought it up. But no, but that's, again, it was an amazing character. Yes, you're right. We fell in love with him. And then so it's interesting to understand how the show comes together and how and when these decisions are actually made, because I think a lot of us still, and I know I did up until recently, now that we've been learning more and more about what happens behind the scenes, but I think for a while, a lot of us still think that episodes are created the way they were back in the episodic television days, 20, 30 years ago, where it's a quicker turnaround. So yeah, these things aren't necessarily known that far in advance, and things in a given season get responded to closer to real time. And the fact that it's not that way anymore, I guess, has its pluses and minuses. You
sure.
know, you get your great story arc, but yet you have
yeah. Yo, we're not, we aren't airing at the same time as we're writing necessarily that season, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, the previous season airs and we get reactions from that, and that might inform us in some ways, and some things could adjust slightly off of the reaction to the previous season. But, you know, once you're committed and you're in a vacuum, you know, literally that first season was like, we created it, we liked it. It looked great to us, but we didn't know what the audience was going to feel yeah. and how they would mm-hmm. react. I mean, we were well into production, late production of season two, when season one aired. Wow. So like, you know, many of those scripts had already been written. And in fact, I want to say, like, I was in the middle of production of episode 8, maybe, when season one aired. Like, that's how the timeline is a little, like, so creating two seasons of television almost in this semi vacuum of experience and just hoping that we're going to touch people in the way we like to be, moved around emotionally, and what is cool for us is going to be cool for the audience, we hope. You know, and that's sometimes we get it right, and sometimes we upset right. people, and that's just the nature of it. And you could do that even if you're writing congruently with airing, you know.
Sure.
And one of the strengths of the show, in my opinion, is how quickly I became attached to the characters.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt like that is something the writers deserve such high props for, is... And the actors, too. I mean, they
absolutely
have to play it well, too. But I just, the characters are so interesting. And the characters we know, like Uhura, are different enough, but still there's the essence there. They've done the writing and the actors doing all that together. It's just, that's one of the things that really impressed me the most about the show. It looks fantastic. The production value is incredible, but it's got the feel that Star Trek fans, I mean,
well,
have been waiting for a little while.
Thank you for that. And, you know, I come from Supernatural, as you mentioned, and that was a show where I learned for me that, yeah, the show is cool and fun and has monsters in it, but people really love the relationship between the brothers and the angels and the demons that are in their lives and the car, you know? And so it's really about these personal collections that you develop, and all the other writers, the shows they come on, they've learned that same lesson. So for us, it was like, let's make sure we're servicing the characters and then make sure our episodic stories are from a perspective of one of our characters, and so we could be with them on this journey and we sort of feel their closeness. All of the actors on the cast are amazing and bringing these characters to life and imbuing them with themselves, and a lot of our writing, you know, we're tapping into these personal places, and you know, each of us is kind of putting a piece of ourselves in them, so that when they do come to life, hopefully, like you mentioned, the people respond because there's something true about what you're being connected to, you know.
No, I have to say that the team that chose the actors for this series picked great actors to portray unique and, you know, memorable characters from Star Trek lore, and have done it very, very well. I mean, even to the point where I remember reading and saying that you chose a Scottish actor to play Scotty.
Absolutely.
And I think that shows that. But even so, every one of your characters are so likable. And here's the really weird one. Your reimagining of James T. Kirk is so damn good.
It works.
It works 100%. It's not just it works. I mean... I like him even more than Shatner. I like him even more than
really?
Chris Pine.
Wow.
Yes, I like him. I like the way that you. Yes,
I'll
love the way
tell
you
Paul
wrote him.
The accolade.
Come on, tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow.
Oh, great.
Was him at his best. Yeah. You made him so human.
Well, you know,
and so likable.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because a lot of times when we try to, you know, bring characters to life or a storyline to life that is going to touch on very established canon and very personal feelings for people in the fandom, we kind of just go back to the source, and we try to go back to the original intentions that we think the creators had. Mm-hmm. And we talked a lot about young James Kirk and he's how people talk about the character and how he was actually portrayed when you watch the episodes. You know, in the 70s and throughout the 80s and 90s, he got the reputation of, oh, well, Kirk's always kissing the alien, or he's the guy with the swagger. And we make jokes, light jokes about that. But the reality is in the series, he was always talked about, oh, he was bookish. Oh, he was the overachiever. Oh, and then you watch some of those episodes, and he's always trying to find a path to empathy, and he's very likable, and he is charming. That's why he gets to kiss the alien, because he's just naturally charming. So we focused it more on the who is this character, not who do you think the character is, but who is the character really? How was he created, designed? How was he written? And what is our reason for bringing them on, and how are we going to use that? You know what I mean? Because you could just very easily we could just write the jokey, oh, he's always trying to hit on the people and that's what he is. But that's such a one note take on the character that we were like, no, let's flesh him out. And he's younger. He's not a cat yet. How would this character be influenced by our Captain Pike of the Enterprise and our, the crew people that are being populating the Enterprise right now?
Yeah. So in Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, in that one, to me, he was most like the original 1960s Kirk more than any other time we see him in the series.
I think that's true. And I think there was a lot of conversation about trying to channel, even, you know, in season two and in that episode, and in the one with Uhura at the space station, we were like, we made some light humor about his reputation, but it was like he was the one who believed her. He was the one that was willing to think out of the box. He was the one who actually sort of empowered her to go through that journey that she was on, all simply because he saw someone who needed help and he wanted to be helpful. You know what I mean?
But even so, your actress who plays Uhura is so wonderful.
She's amazing.
She's so sweet.
Celia.
And she is playing a really well-established and iconic character, and who was played by a remarkable actress. So to step into those shoes is almost like, you know, Zachary Quinto going, oh, yeah, I got to play the most famous character of all Star Trek. And I got to play opposite him in the same movie.
Right, right. I'm sure that was not daunting at all.
No. Yeah. So, I mean, you to do that and to come across and to make her so likable.
Well, she's
she really is.
She's very talented and a total pro. And I think we had conversations in season one about where her character is at. And I think she embodied that so greatly, because it was, yes, everybody knows and appreciates and, you know, Uhura, I always say it wrong, Uhura. like whoever's.
I think all five of us would say it differently,
sentence, I could say Uhura, and I get crap for it all the time because I shouldn't. I should be one of the people who can say it and pronounce it accurately every time, and I don't know why I can't. But anyway, circle back to the actual thing I was trying to say, which was the character was seen as a young person with greatness in them that needs to find the path to allowing that greatness to come out, you know? And so, and it wasn't about the insecurity of that, because you could play that. That's the sort of the one note, but it was the and also the other spectrum of the, I'm so great at everything right away. And that's also not an interesting thing. It's more like you are a character with greatness in them, but you haven't realized it yet, but you know it's there, and other people realize it, and it's how do you foster that greatness without letting it sort of like pressure you and feel a certain way, you know.
Chris, you've been the quietest of the bunch. Will you have any questions? Go ahead, my friend.
Yeah,
Chris.
Sorry, I'm trying to jump in a couple of times. It's okay.
Yes, please do.
I talk a lot. You got to cut me off. I'm super garrulous.
Yeah. So you sort of touched on this with the various characters, but I'm just wondering, just because I think like this feels like it's such an amazing show in that it feels like the original series, but it also feels very modern, and it feels like this is what they would have done, as you said earlier, like this is how they would have made the original series if Star Trek only came out, you know, in 2022 instead of the 60s. How have you been able to manage making it feel like original series but also making it feel like a modern show that doesn't lean too differently from the original series?
Sure. I mean, it's a hard balance. You know, I have to really give a lot of credit to Akiva Goldsman and Henry Alonzo Myers for setting that as a North Star kind of thing in season one. And also Jonathan, our production designer, and costumes, hair, everybody is sort of a full court press about the look of the show, the props, and you know, everyone's a fan and will pull a screen grab from an old episode and be like, hey, this is what it looked like in the 60s. Let's make our version of this. And, you know, so balancing the look and the feel, I think, is a lot of the world itself, you know, right down to the costumes and how can we make them have that classic feel but still feel modern and not silly. And then the stories themselves, you know, I could say for me, I like to watch a lot of all the series, you know, TNG and TOS in particular, and kind of tap into that episodic story and how they maybe approached a topic of their day and how can we approach a topic of our day. And not to totally reimagine and think that I'm going to create something wholly new that's never been told before, but how would we tell it our way? Mm. You know what I mean? And how do we, some tales are unfortunately classic and some morals are not learned, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you have to keep reminding people about tolerance, about peace, about the things that scare us can sometimes make us stronger. You know, those things are people in humanity have been telling their stories since the cave dwelling days. And I'm not going to come up with a new story, but I can come up with a new way of telling it that is going to interest you because it's this world that you love and these characters that mm-hmm. you love. I know I kind of went a little esoteric there, but that is my personal process. And I actually think a lot of the Twilight Zone. I love the Twilight Zone. And I'm like, what would the Twilight Zone episode be? What would the interesting take on this be that makes you go, I didn't think of it that way. Or, I'm slightly uncomfortable about this, but I'm interested, you know.
That's really good.
I'm sorry, Steve.
No, go ahead, Brian.
Has there been anything in the course of seasons one and two that has surprised you that either the writing team went there or the show went that direction, or maybe it's a character arc or something? Is there anything, or maybe a better way to ask it, surprise or just that you particularly really loved, maybe?
Well, I mean, I think it's both. And it's interesting because it's an episode I wrote. I think all of season two had surprising things. You know, the animated crossover, obviously, it's not one I wrote, but I was just surprised we were able to go there. And that's always fun. Mm-hmm. The musical was such a great, you know, that we
really
crossed into a genre that hadn't gone before. But the one that really, like, because I was so inside of it, was the Joseph Mbenga backstory and how this character, who's a beloved doctor, and is it kind of up to that episode, feels like a moral center of the ship, and then you learn that he's a combat veteran with a bunch of confirmed kills that might not have left the war behind. You know, and so I really, when we were like, we're gonna tell this story, I wanted to do it as much justice as possible. And I did a lot of reading. I did a lot of documentary watching, and I talked to combat veterans. at every step of the way, I was like, are they really going to let us do this? Are they really going to let us tell the story? Are they going to say we can't make the doctor be this way? Because, you know, I come from network, and you often get the note kind of early or sometimes late in the game. We don't want to dislike our character. We can't tell the story with this character.
Yeah.
So it was a hard thing to have your character do something, make people uncomfortable, but still be kind of on their side at the end, or at least understand why they were on that side that they were on, even if you weren't on that side with them.
I can tell you, when I watched it, all I could think back was the TV show MASH. And every time the transporter would say, incoming transport, and all I could think about, Radar Riley yelling, incoming!
Yeah,
you've got the Mobile Army Surgical team right there. It was remarkable.
I have no shame in saying I watched a lot of MASH when I was writing that, because like I just alluded to, like, stories have been told before. People have figured out certain things that are effective, and as a creative person, you know, I know the limitations of my own experiences. So I have to research, I have to watch, I have to be inspired, I have to pull from things. And when I was watching MASH, it was two reasons. It was like, how do I keep it interesting and engaging, but also like really have a little gut punch in there for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had about 20 minutes to tell that war storyline. And guess what? MASH episodes were about 22 minutes.
Yes.
So I was like, what would a MASH episode structure be? It's funny and light, but it's also got these dark things. And obviously mine wasn't as funny and light, but I got to create a character that you kind of was quirky with Clint Howard. As I was watching it, I just became like very conscious of that repetitive thing. And then it really hit home when I was watching, I think there's a show called Combat Rescue that's on Lifetime or one of those reality things. And what they had, it was in Afghanistan, I believe. And it was about these combat medics in Afghanistan. And anytime they had to go out into the choppers and go pick up people, they had a bullhorn. And it would say, Leroy Jenkins.
All right, Leroy Jenkins.
And it was this, and at first it's funny. The first time you hear it, it's like, they're using Leroy Jenkins. But after watching that show for a while and seeing the things that, like, that Leroy Jenkins, it was like, oh God, and it weighed on me. And it became a horror to hear that. And I was like, how do I channel that emotional, like, just that sound is evoking this dread, and just please stop, because I know that means young people are dying, you know?
Yeah.
So one of the things, I think you completely nailed it with this, because I've dealt with several friends and other relatives who have struggled with PTSD from combat and non-combat situations in the military, is you completely nailed the sense of, they are unable to talk to those of us who have not experienced it. Like, hit that got, as, because I'm one of those people who they can't talk to, you know, when theory should be able to. So you completely nailed that. That was amazing.
Thank you. And it's funny. I take great pride in that, and I feel honored to get that compliment. And I got a lot of messages actually from people asking me, were you in combat? How did you know, were you there, or did you know someone was there? And the irony, that's not even irony, that's not the right word, but the truth of the matter is, like I said, we often tap into our personal lives. I have PTSD from childhood trauma. And so I could tell a story about PTSD, about what I know to be my experience with PTSD, and just poured it over to it. But at the same time, I do not know what combat is like. I say that front and center. It is a different experience. But I will research, and I will talk to people. I will be informed. I will try to get as close as possible. But when you're talking about the human experience of dealing with trauma, I know some things about that, and that's where it got personal. And I have been that person who can't not share, and I have been that person who looks to alcohol for relief, or has a sudden burst of anger, and then having to not be able to explain where that came from. So that was a very personal story that I was channeling into the writer, and then just put the layer of combat of veteran on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And there's something therapeutic that art like a show like this can do for people. There's a type of, it's not that it's the answer and healing is completed when you watch a TV show that talks right. about this. But I know some people too that are Star Trek fans that have seen combat that saw that episode and just like they nailed it. It was but it was done tastefully. It was done very respectfully as well. And so I think hopefully that's what any person that's been in combat could say that, hey, that honored.
Yeah, and then
we went through, you know,
and that's where I find that to be the best compliment. You know, I don't know what the critics might say about it. I don't know what you know, if you're busting on me because the Klingons don't look like the way you like Klingons. But if the people that have that real experience can say, well, that was actually, you know, and for being a war in space in an imaginary sector of a galaxy. For them to say that's what it felt like for me, that's a huge compliment. And I read the Things They Carried, which was about Vietnam. I read the Dakota Meyer biography that was about Afghanistan. Mm. I was watching these. I was feeling, and I like for months, and like to the point where after the production of that episode and through the rhymes, I needed a break. I was I completely took my family to San Diego on in a resort week and unplugged. And I in the middle of production I think the musical, which came after, I was like, you guys are go singing in space. I just came out of Jigal. I'm going to go to Legoland and SeaWorld and hang out in Carlsbad with my family. Because it was living in me in such a way.
Sure.
You know, we did a review of second season on this show. We talked about it. And I said that this second season truly was Strange New Worlds because you delved into doing Star Trek in a different way, and either was a beautiful crossover episode with Lower Decks, which was just absolutely fantastic, and they had so much fun doing that, and then doing something like Subspace Rhapsody, you know, I kept thinking going back to the Buffy episode where it was a musical, which is acclaimed. And I can listen to the music any day and the same smile comes to my face when I hear it, because it's who came up with the idea to do that? That's the one I'm asking. Maybe
that was, look, I mean, it's hard to nail it to like an individual, because at the beginning of the season, like I said, we all, the writers get in a room, we talk about genres, we talk about things we've done, and I would honestly say that might have even got thrown around season one as kind of like a half joke, right? A joke but not really. And it's like all joke pitches, this is something Dana Horgan always says, all joke pitches become real pitches. and then you know, at the beginning of season two, we talked about what genres haven't we done, and you know, what genres do we want to do again. And, you know, we did talk, you know, Henry Alonzo Myers has done musicals on The Magicians, and Supernatural has done a musical. So we knew that the musical was a format that television does well, the Buffy episode.
Flash did it too.
Yeah, The Flash. And the thing that you mentioned, though, about how beloved the Buffy episode was, is like that was the bar, right? If you're going to do it, you got to have the story matter and not just be singing through the story. And the song's got to be actually, you know, and this is where Dana, who co-wrote that episode with Bill, was very much kind of guiding that through the process. She was like, the songs can't just be catchy for catchy sake. In a real musical, the song actually pushes the story forward, and the scene is the song, right? Yeah. The song actually has an arc in it. You start it and you're in one place, and by the end, you're like, you're in another place. And she was the perfect person to be quarterbacking that experience. And, you know, I was like, great, you guys got the musical. I've got Klingons, you know, killing people, and and the other one that I co-wrote with Kirsten Beyer, I really, really do like the Lotus Eaters one quite a bit, because you're going back to Rigel Seven, which is a part of Pike's canon. You're sort of modernizing.
Yeah, that was cool.
It was like a piece of the cage that you're kind of modernizing for our audiences. And then you're like, in that was this opportunity to do this, the Twilight Zone for me. Like, what is the like little moral story that's underneath everything? That's not like hitting you in the face, but it's there. It's a caste society of the haves and have nots. It just haves memories and have nots memories instead of, you know, money. And so there was this cool world building thing of like, you could watch it, enjoy it, and never get that from it, and just be this, oh, this cool sci-fi world had this weird planet experience. Or you could watch it and be like, oh, they're commenting on disparity, and what does that mean? You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Chris.
Do you have a specific process when you sit down to write an episode? So not when you're necessarily breaking it with other writers, but when you're by yourself and you have your computer open?
I feel like I used to have a conscious process, and now I have a shit, it's due, and I got to sit here and get it done. but to be fair to your question, I think I can probably do that because of a process that I engaged with that has now become like repetitious for me. It's like going to the basketball court
and shooting
free throws, right? And then now I don't got to think about the free throw. And so if I can sort of recall the process for me, you know, the outline is there, right? The outline has been done, and the outline is the roadmap. Mm-hmm. I know that this is the order of events. Mm-hmm. And so I just go in and I say, okay, this was the promise. We promised them this scene. But I know from experience that you don't just make your characters say these words and that makes a scene. That just makes an outline that people are talking about out loud. So you still have to go in and say, where is the activities and points of view that these characters have that make it a scene? And sometimes it's not even there. Sometimes it's, and this is a lesson I learned at Supernatural, was like, you know, at the beginning of every episode, they catch a case. They're this monster killed somebody in Iowa, right? How do you make that interesting for 350 episodes? Well, you find something for them to do. Dean's cooking eggs. Sam's trying to paint something, or the car's broken. So you're like, the scene is actually now this activity. So I think about who's doing something and who wants something, which is an old acting exercise. And it's not even like the words of the, like, this has to be the moment that Pike confronts Lon about something, and that's just a scene I pulled out of my butt, whatever. But how can I make that, like, if the story has already evolved to a point that we know what they're up to, oh, this person's investigating and this person wants answers, that's one thing. But if you're just flat and coming in, you're like, well, I got to make this something. I got to make this, you know, Lon's on the way to the gym and Pike needs to get this answer because Starfleet Command asked him to, you know? And that's not in the outline. The outline was Pike is asking Lon some questions. And so you kind of, it's for me, it's like bringing the characters to life. What is the character going to, where are they coming from? And that's all my acting background. Where are they coming from? What do they want? How do they feel? And then I kind of let them talk to each other, and then they start saying things and that sounds cool. And, oh, they're talking too much. Like, take some of that away, you know?
Are there characters that you find easier to write their dialogue versus harder? Like ones that the voices come more naturally to you, or ones that are harder?
I mean, by this current season that shall not be named, season three, it's sort of a habit. It's sort of like in the beginning, I knew what Spock sounded like, and I had a feeling of what Pike might sound like. And Chapel and Uhura, maybe kind of. Omega, yeah. It was just sort of finding the archetype of, you know, oddly enough, I knew Hammer because, you know, we were talking before the podcast role. He's an engineer and a mentor, and my older brother's an engineer and was a mentor to me. So I knew what I wanted that character to sound like, at least for me when I wrote him, you know. Mm-hmm. He might be written a little differently in other episodes, but for me, I was like, this is my brother. And so even the line about, you know, an engineer's tools are his mind and his hands. I think I had co-written that with Bo, and I think the line he had in there was engineer's tools are his hands. And I was like, no, I know my brother, his best tool is his mind. And so it was just like little things like that, that I was like, just wanting to make sure I brought some point of view to it, you know?
Yeah. And speaking of Hemmer, I just, again, watching that episode originally, episode 9 of season 1, when I realized what was happening, I was like, you know, devastated as I could be watching a show, but at the same time, it was so beautiful. It was just, it was so well done and set up, and we just care deeply. I mean, even in that episode, I think there was, in my opinion, a lot, watching it just recently again, there was a lot done even in that episode that made me like Hemmer even more, so that the impact of him dying was even more effective.
Terrible.
And
it was a rough night. I couldn't sleep. I was just like,
I fell asleep just fine, but
I kept waking up. I get too invested. I kept waking up being like, oh no, Hemmer's dead. But it made for a good podcast afterwards.
I was sorry, unpacking it. I'm sorry and delighted at the same time.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, like, you know, it's like, how do you make people fall in love with a character with the limited amount of time, you know, and Bruce was a big part of that.
Yeah.
Bruce Horak embodied this character, and we showed him playful in the pilot, I believe. Or maybe it was the second episode, the scene where her has to do the captain's dinner. You got a little bit of his playful side. And then in 4,
yeah, that was good.
You know, we kind of wanted to do the grumpy person that you have to earn their respect, right? And so he was kind of like down on her a bit, but then they kind of like, you know, and that was like total submarine movie 101. It was like the sergeant and the private, and the sarge is, you know, hard on you, but then they end up, you know, giving you the best recommendation that you could imagine. And so there was a little bit of that leaning into that, and then it was at 9 in particular, because we were like, well, we are going to kill him in this episode. And it was the end of the season. And it was like, it just so happened that it weaved so greatly with Uhura's own arc of having to find her place here, and to have the person who you kind of like, well, I'm flipping with you and you're the fun, quippy person, to be like, I'm going to talk to you in a real way. Like, I see this need in you, I'm going to call you out on it. And then in tapping into your vulnerability, then I'm going to die, you know? And that scene, like, there was a lot of permeations of that scene, and it just getting it right. And how much is too little, how much is too late. And a couple of things were working for us there. Like, again, Wrath of Khan, the scene of Spock doing the self-sacrifice, total callback to that. And then the words that he spoke was advice my brother gave me in reality.
When
I was a young man and feeling alone in the world, and he's got a very successful marriage, and he had kids before me, much younger than me when he started his family, and that idea of, you know, hey, just find a home, find a person you can follow. Like, he was telling me about relationship advice, but I took that and I how do I take that nugget and make it a little bit more broader and make it more specific for her? But the idea of making a home for yourself, and you'll be happier than you are sad, was totally channeling my brother role.
Wow. That's great.
That's the really engineers give the best advice.
They do.
We do.
And they're always the ones to party and hang out with. He's much more fun than I am.
Yeah. Well, you know, because again, that all came, you know, as an engineer, the mentor relationship also came true because that is a very big part of engineering. And it is something that we discuss all the time to try to, especially the team that I've been working with for the last few years, a lot of, you know, I've been watching my mentors. They've been retiring the last few years. In fact, one of them, you know, when I lamented his retirement, he was like, well, you know, because I'm like, well, who's, you know, going to be the adults around now? And he's like, well, Adina, you're the adult now in the room. And I'm like, what? I still need adults. You're adults around. But the reality is, you know, I've been kind of a mentor in that role as, you know, other people at my level. That's just what we do. That is part of the process. You only learn so much in school. Most of it is on the job and what you learn from your mentor elders in the workplace. So yeah, a lot of that, you know, rang true.
Well, I'm glad. And so now you see where I got it from. And
yeah, you know, that makes sense.
And I think a lot of people can probably, at least in some certain fields, it's true in creative fields too. Like you can only learn what you can by making some mistakes. And then there's hopefully people that are above you and a little bit more seasoned that have made those mistakes already and can say, wait, you might want to look at it this way, or let me save you some time, or you're not going to learn it unless you make the mistake. So go ahead, you know, and all of that is that mentorship journey, you know?
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question with regard to episode 9, which is, when I was watching it again, and you know, it'd been a while since I'd seen it, and I assume that, as you say, other things influence your writing and bring those forward and things like that. And as I'm watching that episode, I am seeing so much of Aliens in it, the movie, the child that's the survivor, the young girl's the only survivor. Yeah. You have the creatures being born out of someone who's a host. You see Sam Kirk acting so much like Bill Paxton's character of overreacting and getting so, we're going to die. We're all going to die, you know? And I just did that. And I again, no one steals because better than James Cameron. He's the greatest stealer.
Sure,
of all time.
Right.
But do other films and things like that, does that get into your mind going, you know, these are really good?
I couldn't sit here with a straight face and say no. You know what I mean? Because clearly, you know, Alien and Aliens were movies of my childhood that I absolutely love, and I'm a big Ridley Scott fan. And it, you know, it's kind of hard to, you're going to do horror in space. So it's kind of hard not to evoke those things. We had talked about, you know, how do lizards procreate and how do we want to make these things, you know, body horror was a big discussion. And so there was a Kayla Cooper had this clip that she showed us of these frogs leaping out of the back of another frog, like the eggs.
Oh, wow.
And so that's where that idea kind of came from.
Okay.
But then it was like, well, this does feel like Alien, and how much do we swerve into this kid and how much do we not? But there was other films that I definitely were pulling from. You know, people don't always mention this one, but Gremlins, you know, tiny monsters wreaking havoc around you and freaking you out. And, you know, the whole sequence of Chapel in the lab and they're all over her is Gremlins, right?
Yeah.
And then also The Thing, you know, the John Carpenter frozen in landscape and the horror of, you know, just this intense, you know, survival and where it's around the corner. And so there was a couple absolute influences that were just seeping. And yeah, look, we have 50 minutes to tell a story that people have told in 2 hours. So what are some shorthands? And I'm sorry, but what are some shortcuts that are just going to get people to understand right away what's happening and what's going on? And we're like, we're putting this little girl here. This is, you know, Newt. Like, are we being stupid for doing this? But ultimately the story was about Lon. And Lon was a little girl when she was on a born breeding planet. And so it was like, look, sure, yes, echoes and shades, and it's very parallel. but this very specifically calls back to Lon, and that's why we decided to, yes, we need to do it this way, you know.
No, it worked perfectly, and just, I mean, it was the right level of terror that was needed. Mm-hmm. And then we get into episode 10 of season 2 and you go, holy moly, you've really pushed the Gorn to like, oh, these things are evil.
Yeah. Evil. Right. And at this phase in our canon, they can be that for us, right? Because we, not until Kirk has to be stranded on you know, it's not Cestus, but the planet just beyond Cestus, with a Gorn, do we learn to maybe empathize with them. Right now, they are the unknown, and nothing is more scarier than the unknown. And Akiva had a real strong vision for this in particular, because he said, and he's correct, Trek always teaches you to identify with your enemy. Trek always teaches you that everything can be worked out, that we just need to find our common ground. And he's like, how do you do that when you are faced with something so unknown and so foreign that you just cannot find the common ground right now? And so that was like in its concept of how to write. That's why we didn't see them at all in that first episode, because we would identify with them too much if we got to see them. Mm-hmm. They're just the things in that ship that want us dead, you know. And we hear them and we know they're out there, but it's just you know,
the unknown enemy, the unseen enemy. It's terrifying because you don't know what you're dealing with. Yeah. And then, except one person, and she did it as a child, and she had those nightmares, those monsters.
And she's telling you can't reason with them. Your only, your reliable, quote unquote, maybe unreliable because of her experience, person is telling you, don't bother talking to them. And so, okay, so what do? We run, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I have a general comment. I'm a music guy. I love talking about music compositions, especially with Trek. I think Star Trek has a rich and vast history of fantastic music associated with it. And to put that into kind of the realm of writing, I really feel like Strange New Worlds in season 1 and 2 is this beautiful symphony of different movements and pieces and adventures we get to go on, like we would some of the great symphonies or a great musical score of a film we love. I just want to say kudos to you and the rest of the team. Like, it just, we went on such a journey, and it was, it was fun. Mm-hmm. And episodes were different from each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's our composers, right? It's Nami, that's Jeff. It's like, there is conversation of evoking themes that we are familiar with and using those. And then also the genre helps, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is a genre. What is the music that is best in that genre? When is it a sweeping adventure? When is it a slightly more melodic moral tale, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Well, I'm very happy that they decided to, at the end of season 1 of Discovery, decided to bring back the Enterprise, Captain Pike, number one, these characters, and the fact that they decided, you know what, this came out so well, we ought to make our own TV series about it. And how we get, we're lucky to have gotten Strange New Worlds to watch.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And I think probably the, in addition to that, one of the best decisions that was made in the inception phase before I even got on board was to make it an episodic show and let you have a 1 week adventure, let you fall in love with characters who will evolve over the course of these 10 adventures. But like to give you the self-contained, I think that actually has a lot of goodwill for all these comments we get about you evoke it so well and the classic Trek so well, because classic Trek was this little hour that you got. And you were told a premise that then kind of resolved itself, however that happens by the end. And that, I think, was a huge value and a part of the reason, I think, for the success that we enjoy is to be able it makes things easier and it makes some things harder. You know, it's a different type of storytelling. You know, you can't lean on four episodes of you know, building to a thing that then you're so invested to, like you have to really get people invested in that, you know, brief amount of time that you have for your setup. But the payoff is great, because at the end you feel like, I understood what that episode was and why they did it. And whether you liked it or not, it's another story, you know?
Yeah, because to me, you seem to have captured the best of both worlds, where you have every episode is essentially self-contained. There's a story, it resolves itself, and then you go into the next one. But you still have a through line. You still have Pike dealing with his future trauma. You still have all the other characters and their storylines, but like balanced in such a way that it's not favoring one. Like, it's obviously favoring standalones, but it's not to the detriment of, well, I wish these characters would change. Right. So I think that's just, what a perfect balance.
Well, thank you. Yeah, but that was also part of the design. It was like, you know, episodic stories and serialized character arcs, you know, and that was very much intentional. And you don't want your characters to have amnesia and not have had the experience of 2 weeks ago. But at the same time, like, much like in life, we're not always talking about the thing that's on our mind. And so you don't have to be like constantly having scenes about a thing. It wasn't like Lon in season one, every episode was like, oh, that Gorn breeding planet, or oh my God, the Gorn are going to come get me someday. It was established. There was an adventure about that. It was kind of in the background, and then an adventure really brought it to the fore. And you know, same with Pike. It was the, oh, I know my destiny. Is this going to make me a good captain or not? None of that matters. I'm just going to have the time that I have. It's on his mind. It's on his mind. And then in the finale, it's like, oh, you haven't really fully resolved this, and here's a whole story about that. And so you couldn't have had that finale if you didn't understand the character, maybe, but you could have still had that finale, because you could just set up your future self as coming and you're about to make a mistake, and here's a lesson about making that mistake, you know?
When you're in the writing room with your fellow writers and you're working on a script, or you have written a script, does it go around the room? Like when you wrote the fourth episode of season one, did the script go around the room, and do they all go, yeah, Davey, this is just beautiful. Yeah. Let's just put it on the refrigerator because it's perfect. There's nothing wrong with it at all. Or do they go, do they each import a little advice to you, and then you go, you know, you're right, and I'm going to change that because this is what the character should have done or would do or whatever. Yeah.
Well, I, you know, it's interesting because I'm at the upper levels a little bit. So, and even with the lower levels, I shouldn't quantify that with, you know, all writers are talented and they're all on a journey, but it doesn't really go round robin. What kind of happens is that the script comes out and everybody reads it. And then like a few people will come and say, really liked it, but there's this one moment that, you know, I thought this could be a funny joke there. Or, hey, I was reading it and you kind of got me confused here. And so these sort of ad hoc things happen. But like with me, I would get specifically notes from Henry and Akiva, right? Because they were the writers
upstairs.
Above me.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. And so they would say, we read it. Here's some of the changes that we think would make it better, some of the things that we were expecting that didn't happen, or, hey, you gave us exactly what we expected, but it doesn't work. And so that process kind of, you know, the notes from above, that
okay.
still happens, you know, and then we hand it to our, you know, production partners at Secret Hideout, and they will give their round of thoughts. And then we hand it to the studio and the network. And so it all kind of spirals upwards. You certainly, and then there's a table read, and then after the table read, actors will have questions. Hey, I kind of felt funny in my mouth. And and then, you know, the writers will have been on the table read and watched it, or been in the room and said, you know, I didn't catch this before, but now I'm going to get. So it's constantly getting refined. Like, you're not wholesale, like, pulling all these threads. You know, the bulk of the work is kind of done in the front half of it. And then it just goes through the pipeline of collaboration to just kind of be at the place. The directors who come on will say, look, I have to shoot this. But you know what? This location doesn't exist, and we don't have it on a stage. And could it move? Could it be this way? It's easier for me to put the camera here. Or I had this great idea to emotionally make you feel something if I can do this, but that means this line might not work. So you're just working in that collaboration of everybody just trying to make it better, you know?
So how does that dovetail with your role as a producer? I mean, is it a similar hat? Is it really a different hat that you wear?
It's a similar hat. So that, yeah, I mean, look, there's the writing phase where you put a bunch mm-hmm. of things down on the page. And then there's the producing phase where you're trying to bring those things to life. And I think I've done this enough to be able to decouple those two a little bit. Mm-hmm. When you're kind of just getting to see some of the first things that you've written come to life, there's a tendency to hold on to everything because you work so hard for it, or because
kill
you know,
your darlings.
Yeah, or because you know, like, oh my God, the studio really liked that moment, or oh my God, the. But then, as you've done this enough, and you've seen enough of these episodes go through the editing process, and you've seen them go from what they look like, you realize that some fights are not vanity innate. I don't say, but they're just a mm-hmm. a. It doesn't change the needle one way or the other. And is this really the moment that I need to adjust? And then there's moments that it is, and you have to know the difference. You know, you have this, is this important enough? And sometimes it could be as simple as a word, like, they're using the wrong word. Does it have the same intention? You know, and it's a small thing, but like saying someone can do something versus someone is able to do something might have a different meaning in a scene. And one might sound condescending, and so you're just like a tiny little thing, or it might not, and you're just fighting the wrong fight, you know. And so that muscle is very much the producer muscle, also the oh my God, I'm watching this and this is too long, and it read really great, but like it's too long. Now do I tell the director to pace it up and make the actors talk faster, or do I cut a few lines? You know,
so you are there when they're filming the episode. You are there as executive producer and
personally for the episodes I've written, absolutely, and then at times for helping out on other episodes that I'm sort of in that mentoring process, or mm-hmm. the writer couldn't be there for other reasons. And so, you know, who's going to pitch in? So yes. And you know, the producing on set part of this, you know, it's interesting because it's a big, when we met on the strike line, right. And that's a big part of what the guild was trying to bring back. You know, I have been fortunate in my experience in the broadcast circles and in the, you know, 22 episode full order procedural circles to have had that experience, to have had that sort of factory floor, to have had the scene, something go from idea to the edit bay to air. And there are lessons and skills that you just cannot learn unless you go through that process. And so that's, the guild was sort of trying to remind the industry that this is how television has been made for decades, literally, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. it's changed, and guess what, it's making things harder and more difficult, and actually you're feeling it now too, because there's this whole bunch of talented people that are missing out on part of their job, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that was a good question I had written down that I was wanting to ask you was, you know, when I met you, it was right in the heat of the strike for both the writers and the actors, and you were forbidden to talk or promote. We couldn't ask right. you to be on the show at that time because you couldn't discuss blah blah, as it was called at that time,
right? Mm-hmm. Star Trek.
How did what did you do during that period of time while the strike was going on? How did you keep yourself in tune? I mean, you know, it's the off season and I'm going to go to the batting sure. cage and keep working on my batting swing, or I'm going to keep throwing fastballs to keep myself tight.
I mean,
what did you do during the time that you were on strike?
I went camping a lot with my kids. I went on some road trips. I read some books, and I kind of unplugged, actually, because I did need a little bit of a break. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I really impressed upon me that I really wanted to come back with is you know, we are telling stories and we're hoping to tap into a human experience.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm living in a fictional headscape and I'm making stories just sort of, I know this works paint by numbers. I know I have to do this beat here. I know that the act out has to be here. And so I get to, I might actually sort of start being circular and insular and being too formulaic. So that time I really just said, what is my experience of life with my kids and, mm-hmm. and how am I kind of being a family man? Where am I in the world? I did a little bit of that artist introspectiveness
mm-hmm.
to kind of reset myself creatively so that I don't come in going, this is all going to be this. I know this is this, move on. And I really was like, no. What is the human experience? What is mm-hmm. the audience experience? What is the thing that is going to elevate this to be saying something? Mm-hmm. Because you could forget those things. And because it is, like we touched on earlier, so much a repetition of form, I don't want to lose why I'm doing the form. What am I using the repetition for, not just for its own sake? You know what I mean?
But you were excited to get back to writing when it was over with.
Absolutely. I mean, to engage creatively and almost immediately once the strike ended, you know, was thinking about Star Trek, but also thinking about other stories that I might want to tell outside of, you know, of Trek, you know, to be blasphemous for a second. But, you know, just
it's okay. We like other things too.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yep. Well, you know, yeah, is ancillary, not in replacement of.
Yeah.
Is there places where I can, you know, as I wait between seasons, do something in what would that be? And in a kind of really fun, interesting way, I think what I found is, you know, I am a genre guy and I love that, you know, because there was a moment of like, oh, I got to get back to straight ahead drama or real world. What would my real world stories look like? But then I sort of just really had the moment to be like, you know what? I found the wheelhouse, sci-fi, fantasy, horror. And it's a fun wheelhouse. Yeah. And there are different there are different types of those genres now. It is not a bad word. It is not a thing that only hacks do. Mm-hmm. You know, there's elevated, there's pulp, there's comedy within it. And so I kind of found this niche of embracing the label of the, you know, if you look at the body of work, like I deserve that label. That is kind of what I do. Doesn't mean I can't do the other things. If something came along that I was really like, ooh, that's a detective story, or ooh, I want to do that. But, you know, I have a comfort zone. I have a go-to place. It's there. And so don't fight that. You know what I mean?
Is there a novel in you? Because we have a couple of novelists right here.
I think there used to be one. But I think there's like, probably there's a TV show and a film in front of the novel. You know what I mean? There's other things that are like, I think the novel is for like when I'm like, I'm tired of being on set and being away from my family. Like, I'm just going to go away world and let me have 6 months, you know, maybe. But I think there's, you know, I have directing aspirations and that's something.
That's cool.
That's good. Now, because we've talked about that, is that some people are just, they're novelists. And they're not script writers. And some people are script writers and they're not novelists.
Yeah, and I think I live in the cinematic world. I think I live I can be quick with a script. I can shorthand, like if someone points out a story problem in a script, I can fix that very quickly and turn that around. I think a novel is a unique great, you know, piece of literature, and I would be so lost, and I would be just me, you know, I'd write the 400 pager that makes no sense. You know, I think it just the having no sense of the process guidelines or boundaries. I think with a script, I know the limitations, and then I also know like when to ignore those and just go for it, because it that's the point in the story where you have to do that. You know what I mean?
So, right. Yeah. That's kind of funny that you say that. So I'm assuming you're familiar with the Save the Cat beat stuff.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
I am.
Because that's actually what I use to write my novels, is that,
oh, really?
That structure. Well, and there's actually a book. So Save the Cat is a method or a structure for structuring writing. It came right. out of the film and TV industry. But there's then an application of that. And specifically, someone wrote a book, Save the Cat Writes a Novel.
Oh, and, that's cool.
Yeah, and that is after reading like 1,000 different structure books and things like that, the Save the Cat was the one that resonated. The most.
I didn't really buy into Save the Cat. I did the Sid Field books I read when I was kind of really early in my process. But then I went to junior college and took some film courses, and was actually the thing that really worked well with me and actually worked great for television is what they call a reel theory, which is and it goes back to the original films were 8-minute reels. And those 8-minute reels had to, because of the film stock, literally was a practical reason why shorts were 8 minutes long. And the first sort of features, and we're talking silent black and white movies, were basically 8-minute reels that were played back to back to back. And so you could have a half hour, but it was really like 4 8-minute reels. And because of the practical reason of having to take a reel off and put it back on, every 8 minutes was a mini little cliffhanger. Every 8 minutes was like, so every little 8 minutes had to have a satisfying story and make you want to come back for more. So the 8-minute reel theory is basically, as you're telling a cinematic story, where are you in the story that like you're keeping them hooked? Like you got it. Where are you bringing them in? And you know, I'm not so rigid. I'm not going like, oh shit, it's page 8, it's page 16, but. In television, you have caked in act breaks. You have those moments that what are you reeling people in? And it goes back to, you know, we don't really have commercials in streaming. We have ads, but in back in the day, it was like, and now we're going to cut to the car commercials and you better come back. And how are you not going to change the channel? And so that theory of keeping them engaged, keeping them interested, and then, keeping them. What's the question they're asking that's going to make them want to come back for the answer? You know,
the 3-act story is you've got the first, 10 minutes of TV and then the next 10 minutes and, and you're breaking because, and you've got a car commercial in between each one of those things to carry you in.
Yeah. It's like, I know where I want to take you. How do I keep you interested enough to take you to that one place?
Well, you're very definitely doing it in Strange New World very well.
Oh, yes, well, definitely.
So I have to ask a very
go self, ahead, Chris, please.
I have to ask a very selfish question because I'm going through film school right now. And so I'm just curious for myself and anyone who's listening who's also maybe aspiring to direct or write, what advice would you have for someone who's not in the industry but would like to get into the industry?
Do it. Just don't wait for someone to tell you to do it. Go and get – if you could – afford a cheap camera, get a cheap camera used, get an old and just shoot stuff that you don't plan to show anybody, shoot. And I say this because it's the process I've done. It's the process that I've seen very many successful people have done. I took college courses at a junior college because if you took the film classes, you got access to their mini DV cams. And so I got access to the mini DV cams and I did the course, but I also made another short with their cameras, and I learned so much doing that. And you can only learn by doing it. And no one's ever going to tell you or give you permission and say, oh, you're ready now. Or, oh, yeah, now's the time to do it. I wish I had kind of known that sooner. I kind of felt it and I was doing it intuitively. Like I was taking my parents' camcorders and using my G.I. Joes to tell little cinematic stop action short films just because I wanted to do that. And I was doing that just for fun. And then as an adult, like I was a struggling actor. And the thing about being a struggling actor is you need people to hire you, right? Same with the director. You need someone to maybe give you money to make your short. As a writer, you just need time and motivation. And then I kind of realized as a director, I don't need money. I could make low budget just for me, just to put a camera in my hand, just to know that if I look this way and then I try to edit it, I crossed the line and I did a mistake. but that mistake cost me what, like $8 of a VHS tape, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I practice. It's like practicing. Like if you want to, you can't be a painter and not paint on canvas. You know, it doesn't mean you're going to get an expensive oil and go and get this big, it just, no, but you're going to get a sketchbook and you're going to practice and you're going to practice. So if you want to be a filmmaker and you want to do a cinematic story, you got to practice putting stories on screen, you know, and as hard as that might be to share with people, or as hard as it might be to watch, because you're like, fuck, I suck. They're not for, right. They're, you know, those first pieces aren't meant to be shared, you know? They're just like, you know, if you have an idea for a scene and you want to see what it looks like on screen, here's the other great part, right? Actors want to act, and there's acting schools out there of all of these people who want experience. And so if you find a group of people, that's the other piece of advice. Find yourself a group of people that are want to have learning experiences and want to have fun doing this with you, and that you're all kind of at the same level. If someone's above you or someone's below you, it's going to be a little difficult. But if everyone is kind of at your same level ground of trying to break in, about to break in, and just like, hey, you know, I want to do a short on Saturday. It's going to be like 4 hours of work. I'll buy a pizza. We'll do a scene from your class or a scene that I wrote, and you'll get to practice being on camera. I'll get to be practicing where I put the camera. I'll get to see how bad I am with the lights I rented or the lights I own, whatever. And then shoot it, and then and try to edit it, and then go, God, there's a lot I need to learn. But I learned something the last time. I want to try the next one to be a little better. You know what I mean?
That's fantastic advice.
That's cool. Good advice.
No, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. Any other questions? I mean, we could go on for another couple hours.
I know.
Because you've been so wonderful, I have, Davey, with us. But go ahead, Chris.
One last question if we have time. I have to talk about this and ask this. Is on behalf of every Canadian listening to this, tomorrow, what went into the process of deciding that it's going to be in Toronto? Because to me, like, everything that's filmed in Toronto is either New York or it's a Canadian show.
Right.
So to have an American show like Star Trek be filmed in Toronto and have it be Toronto was like a huge moment.
I'm glad. And it's funny because it was, and this is maybe telling a little bit of the where the bodies are buried. It was in its inception, also a good movie.
Very good.
Going to be in New York. And we were like, hey, we could shoot Toronto as New York. And maybe the Brooklyn Bridge is blown up, or, you know, what are the things that are very New York? And then we were like, we are going in circles to try and cheat a city that's actually an iconic city with its Space Needle and its own elements. And why don't we just embrace the Toronto-ness of it? And that was kind of a fun moment of like, oh yeah, like there are no rules.
We're in a city.
Not only it's like, it's, you know, Earth in an alternative future, and, you know, not everything has to be so Americana-centric. It's Star Trek. We are in Toronto. It's easy for production. It's kind of fun for the story. Now, what is it about this that is going to kind of inform the script now? And we just leaned into it, and it really kind of actually, it was that moment of like, aha, this is going to bring certain things to life for that particular episode.
And it was refreshing, too, to see not New York being used.
Right. You know, My hometown has gotten beat up quite a bit.
I was quite ready for us to get destroyed, at least by one alien space station.
You've seen that, right?
LA got blown up in War of the Worlds and Independence Day. It's time for somebody others. Let's wreck another city.
LA, finally. Chicago, Boston, you know.
I still want the Independence Day, what was happening in Toronto story. But I have to say, though, like watching that first, the season 2 trailer and be like, oh my gosh, is that the Root Store? Is that a Toronto Maple Leaf jersey in Star Trek? I'm like, that's incredible.
Yeah, I love the fact that Kirk goes out to lunch and he goes, gravy on French fries? I mean, this is crazy. Oh my gosh.
It's like, that is from Toronto?
Canadian. It's wonderful.
Yeah, from Toronto.
I guess is something we should be proud of. But
absolutely.
Yeah, that was a really, really nice treat.
Oh, well, thank you.
my old boss, she originally was from Canada, and when she went to a restaurant here in LA and they put gravy on French fries, she almost broke into tears. She was like, oh my God, this is just like home, you know? Oh. Yeah.
Nice. Before I sign off, I just want to say thank you for having me. I love being here, and hopefully you'll have me back sometime.
Thank you for your time.
Just say the word. Just let us know when.
We'll after season 3 has been aired, we would love to have you on it to chat about that when it's legal.
I'd love to be back.
There you have it, folks. A little insight into the workings of a writer for Strange New Worlds. We, the Big Sci-Fi Podcast team, are so appreciative of had on our show someone of the caliber of Davey. It allows us to get to know how a TV show like Strange New Worlds is produced. As I've stated before, without a scriptwriters, there wouldn't be any characters, any story, nothing. It all begins with the written word, and we are so happy that the writers and actors strike ended, and that we can look forward to season 3 of Strange New Worlds. Yes, folks, when it's legal, we'll chat about it then. If you have any comments on this episode or any other episodes, please share them at Facebook or Instagram pages, or send us an email to thebigscifipodcast@gmail.com. Your positive comments help to support us and move us up the pecking order of podcasts, both nationally and internationally. I'm talking about you, Norway. You hear me? Thanks again to Trek Geeks for supporting us, and we look forward to meeting you at Trek Long Island on May 31st through June the 2nd. Get those entry tickets, airline tickets, room accommodation, so we can meet you there, as well as the folks as well as other folks and our fellow podcasters from Trek Geeks. We plan to have fun and games at the event, but above all, to meet new or old friends, like I did on September the 8th when I met our interviewee, Davey Perez. As they sang on The Simpsons, a stranger is a friend you haven't met. And as always, let me close by saying, keep watching the skies, live long and prosper.